I'm not putting it in my pocket because I'm handing it off to Dr. Helmreich. Just before I begin, this may have been done earlier, but it hasn't been done in my presence, primarily because I've just arrived. But Rabbi Kelman needs to be tremendously congratulated for the tremendous work of organizing the diversity of subjects. Bringing speakers from literally from other parts of the world to hear and making this available for all of us is a tremendous act of scholarship and kindness that he confers on us. And this afternoon, in this session, you're in for a treat because you will be hearing a scholar, but a scholar who isn't simply a scholar in the Tower of Academe. He descends from the Tower of Academia into the battlefield, as it were, onto the streets and into the fields. Normally, I do not read an entire biography of any speaker or author. In this case, I will digress from my normal custom because it'll actually show you, this mini biography will show you how diverse and varied Dr. Helmreich's experiences and writings are. William B. Helmreich is professor of sociology and Judaic studies at City University Graduate Center and City College of New York, and director of the City College Conflict Resolution Center. He was also department chairman and has held visiting posts at Yale University and Hebrew University. A former Woodrow Wilson fellow, Dr. Helmreich is the author of 11 books, including Against All Odds, Holocaust Survivors, and The Successful Lives They Made in America, which was the winner of a National Jewish Book Award. Also, The Things They Say Behind Your Back, The World of the Yeshiva, editor of Letters from Tel Mond Prison, An Israeli Settler Defends His Acts of Terror. He has written for the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, and many scholarly journals. Dr. Helmreich has also appeared frequently on TV and radio, including Larry King Live, Oprah Winfrey, the CBS Morning News, Sally Jesse Raphael. Most recently, he has been a guest anchor on NBC TV News. At the present time, he is serving as a senior consultant to an upcoming documentary film on the Middle East conflict. This past summer, Dr. Helmreich traveled Israel as a journalist. He wasn't traveling as a scholar per se. He wasn't traveling with an academic imprimatur. He was traveling with a notebook and a pen and a tape recorder and speaking to people from left and from right. And he's speaking to members of Hamas. And we are the beneficiaries of his experiences and his unique presentation. I will just give the floor over to Dr. Helmreich. I will end the meeting at 5 minutes to three, which gives us about an hour and 5 minutes to hear an engaging presentation and invite you all to ask questions. Of course, I'll try not to allow personal presentations in the guise of questions, but to enable everybody to ask questions or as many people as possible, I'll pin you down to bona fide questions. So let me turn the floor and the mic over to Dr. Helmreich. And thank you.
We're very close. Okay. I trust that, can you hear me? Okay, if you say no, you have a problem. At least the problem with me, because I'll wonder. We all know that Israel is a battlefield today and has been from its inception. But in North America, by which I mean from Rutgers to Concordia College, the American campuses are a battlefield. And the purpose of doing this film was to present a film that would be able to be shown both on television and on college campuses across this continent that would explain what's really going on in the Middle East. Now, if we had decided to do a film that was, say, for argument's sake, a pro-settler film, a Gush Emunim film, I could have shown that in my basement. And I could have shown it perhaps to an audience like this, but I could never get it past the censorship that exists on American college campuses. So please understand that everything is seen in context and that the purpose of this film is to present a film about about the Middle East that tells the story in more or less objective fashion, but that hopefully at the end of the day when you see it, you will at the very least understand Israel's position a lot better, a position which is not given an audience on campuses, except at Hillel houses. And perhaps you will also feel greater sympathy towards Israel. So understand that this is a film for Jewish and non-Jewish students on campuses in this country, students who have absolutely very little background in terms of the Middle East conflict. And it was with that in mind that we did it. So we have a little bit of a crowded schedule for this. I'm going to begin by showing you the promotional clip that was prepared, because you know we're going to market this to major television stations in the United States and here. So when you do that, you have to prepare a 12 and a half minute promo video, as they call it, and it contains selections and excerpts. Now since this promo video was done, we have already done the whole film, but I don't have that available for you, nor would I be allowed to show it to you at this stage. But in the period of time since the film, the promo, was first shown, I traveled to Gaza, as Mordechai indicated, and I interviewed Abdel Rantisi, who is the head of Hamas in Gaza. I interviewed Mahmoud Dahlan, who was the chief of security during the short-lived and ill-fated Mahmoud Abbas period. And there were interviews with Sheikh Ahmed Yassin and other people. So what I selected today was to show you, which I'll show you later, some isolated comments from Abdel Rantisi and from Mahmoud Dahlan, so that you'll get a sense of the flavor. I did those interviews, but and in the tape you'll see me asking certain questions which may not be as clear as his answers, at least audibly. I don't mean conceptually. And you'll be able to judge for yourself, and I'll try to leave enough time to take some questions too. So first, let's show the 12 and a half minute promo. It's a lot to absorb, a lot of images flashing across the screen in a very compressed amount of time, but let's try and deal with a couple of things. One of the people that I interviewed last January was Ahmed Bitawi, Sheikh Bitawi, who, as you saw, was a man in the white hat who was praying and who said, "We will never give up," etc., etc. I said to Sheikh Bitawi, I said, "Tell me something. We in the West value human life above all else. So what I would like to understand, if you could explain it for our audience, is why is it that when your children are martyrs, you seem happy? When your children die in a burst of flame, in an explosion, you smile, sometimes you laugh. The mother gets on the TV and says, I'm sorry, I only have one life to give because my other children aren't available, or whatever the reason is. And when your houses are destroyed, you cry, you wail, you moan, you're anguished. Why is it that you feel so much more strongly about your property being destroyed than about your children dying? Don't you love your children?" Well, he looked at me and he said, "This question demonstrates that you don't have the slightest idea what our movement is all about. You should know that those martyrs are like angels sent to us from heaven. And you should understand that we regard them as going on to another life, and that we view their sacrifice as a supreme sacrifice for our just cause. Do you think for a moment," he went on to say, "that the World Trade Center collapsed because Osama bin Laden made it collapse, or the other people? It collapsed because God wanted it to collapse. Those people died because it was God's will. Otherwise, how could it have happened? Don't you also believe that everything is God's will? And if so, how do you explain it except for the fact that we are right and you are wrong? Difficult words, my friends, but you need to hear them. Because one of the biggest mistakes that we make in life, and it's only because we're human beings, is that we assume that whoever we meet basically thinks like us, that they're in our Miss Garrett and our framework. The problem is, they aren't always. And when you understand that you're dealing with a different authority structure, with a totally different mentality, then you must understand that your words of peace, talk, compromise, let's negotiate, are irrelevant. When a person adopts a maximalist position, there's no halfway point at which to meet them. We need to grasp that concept. And it's a concept that was brought home to me time and time again. This summer, I went to Gaza City. I had to pass through customs. The Israelis told me I had to sign a document. They're not responsible for me. And they urged me not to go. They said I would be killed, but thank God, I'm here. I went to see him. If you remember, there was an attack. There had been an attack in June on Rantisi's life. And he even had a video that he showed me. He had a video of himself being attacked. You'll ask me, how's that possible? Well, because unemployment is high in Gaza, and they have people running around with video cameras who just photograph everything in the hope that they'll see some action, and then they sell the tape to news agencies like Reuters. So I was in his home, and he put a VCR into a TV, and he was showing me how his car was firebombed and how he escaped. He was still sporting a leg wound that he received in that particular incident. And of course, you know, it was a difficult situation. There were people with their rifles trained on me as I went. I went myself because if I had gone with other people, it would have looked like I was afraid, and that's the last thing in the world you want to do in that kind of situation. And we spoke for about an hour. And the only people with me were the members of the Arab TV crew who had worked with us last time, who were based in Ramallah. So I want to show you a small snippet of an interview, and I want you to focus in particularly on what Mr. Rantisi said when asked about the difference between Sharon and Peres, just so you understand the position that's being articulated. So if you don't mind, let's do the Rantisi tape, as we said before. Never mind what we read in the New York Times or the Toronto Globe and Mail. They have it straight from the source, from the head of the organization. You know, we were doing an interview. Well, the first thing that I want to say is that when I asked Sheikh Batawi, who heads Hamas on the West Bank, this question about whether or not Hamas and the PA were the same, his response was very interesting. And the question is very important because in the American media, strenuous efforts are always made to isolate the radicals of Hamas and to deal only with the Palestinian Authority as though they were different. But it became clear to me in my travels, and I spent full days, 12 hours a day, sitting in a car with Palestinians, that there really is no difference between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas. It's a myth concocted through the process of wishful thinking and destined to lead us down a very, very bad path. Of course, hope springs eternal in the human breast. That saying didn't become trite for nothing. But the fact of the matter is that it may be an illusion. And Sheikh Batawi said to me, you think that Hamas and the Palestinian Authority are different? They're two sides of the same coin. After all, he said, in every single family in the West Bank, you have children. One brother belongs to Islamic Jihad, one belongs to Hamas, another one belongs to the Palestinian Authority. Are they not brothers? So, you know, this distinction, we differ on the tactics, but we do not differ on the goals. Now, if the Palestinian Authority were headed by Mahmoud Abbas and not by Arafat, the situation would be different. But you need to look at an op-ed piece printed in the Wall Street Journal in September, in early September, that was written by Ion Pasepa, who was the KGB's man for many years and who was the head of the Romanian Secret Service. He wrote an article in which he said as follows: before I defected to America from Romania, leaving my post as chief of Romanian intelligence, I was responsible for giving Arafat about $200,000 in laundered cash every month throughout the 1970s. I also sent two cargo planes to Beirut a week, stuffed with uniforms and supplies. Other Soviet bloc states did much the same. Terrorism has been extremely profitable for Arafat. According to Forbes magazine, he is today the sixth wealthiest among the world's kings, queens, and despots, with more than $300 million stashed in Swiss bank accounts. So don't feel so sorry for him when he gets exiled from Ramallah. I invented the hijackings of passenger planes, Arafat bragged. Actually, the KGB did. The KGB chairman, Yuri Andropov, in February of 1972, said, as follows, he said, "We laughed about the Yankee gullibility for celebrities. We had outgrown Stalinist cults of personality ourselves, but those crazy Americans were still naive enough to revere national leaders. We would make Arafat into just such a figurehead and gradually move the PLO closer to power and statehood." Andropov thought that Vietnam-weary Americans would snatch at the smallest sign of conciliation to promote Arafat from terrorist to statesman in their hopes for peace. Right after that meeting, I was given the KGB's personal file on Arafat. He was an Egyptian bourgeois turned into a devoted Marxist by KGB foreign intelligence. The KGB had trained him at its Balashika special ops school east of Moscow, and in the mid-1960s decided to groom him as a future PLO leader. First, the KGB destroyed the official records of Arafat's birth in Cairo, replacing them with fictitious documents saying that he had been born in Jerusalem and was therefore a Palestinian by birth. Are these the rantings of someone from the community of Tapuach in Yehuda and Shomron, or are these words that appeared in the Wall Street Journal, which checks its sources? And then, what did we have on October 23rd, 1998? President Clinton concluded his public remarks to Arafat by thanking him for, quote, "decades and decades and decades of tireless representation of the longing of the Palestinian people to be free, self-sufficient, and at home." The current administration sees through Arafat's charade, but will not publicly support his expulsion. Meanwhile, the aging terrorist has consolidated his control over the Palestinian Authority and marshaled his young followers for more suicide attacks. You know, as I traveled through the area, that became clear. We interviewed a family of the suicide bomber, a woman who had been intercepted on her way to carry out a suicide attack in a small village outside of Jenin. And after it was over, one of the one of the siblings of the suicide attacker said to us, "You know, I'm an artist. Would you like to see my studio?" So we said, "Sure, let's see your studio." And we went downstairs to a machzan, if you will, those of you who have been in Israel, a little basement. And we walked in, and the room was half of the paintings, portraits in this room, were of Saddam Hussein. So I said to the fellow, "Tell me something." I said, "You know, you paint beautifully, but why do you have all these? Isn't one enough? Why do you have all these paintings of Saddam Hussein?" "I love Saddam Hussein," he said. "He is my idol. He is my hero." One evening, I was in Ramallah. We were waiting to interview Arafat. And I went out for a walk with a 27-year-old TV technician. And we walked through the streets of Ramallah. And as we were walking, I said, "You know, Ahmed, it's just you and me here. Nobody else is listening. What do you really think of this guy, Arafat? I mean, what do you make of him? You like him?"
he says, like him. I hate him. He's a dictator. He's a corrupt dictator. He takes all the money away from the people. He doesn't listen to anybody except his own group of people. I hate him. I said, who do you like? Ah, he says, you want to know who's a great, great leader? I said, who? He says, Hitler. I said, really, why? He says, I love Hitler because Hitler knew what to do with the Jewish people. And I said to him, but you know, Hitler was also a dictator. I feigned ignorance, you know, when he first said Hitler. I said, oh yeah, the German guy. Because I realized I wasn't in such a good place. And I say, Hitler was a dictator too. He says, yes, he was a dictator. And that part about him I hate. And here he showed his ability to compartmentalize. But I love the part about the Jews. So honestly, folks, all I could think about was, when are we going back to the restaurant? I want to get out of here. I want to make sure things don't go too wrong. Now, he was a technician. He was not a Hamas leader. I spent a lot of time with him. He was a nice guy. You know, that's what we don't understand. A lot of these people are nice guys. But not when it comes to the state of Israel and to the Jewish people. When Rantisi says that the only just solution will be for the Palestinian refugees to come back, and he enumerates that there are 7 million of them, what do you think will happen if even only 1 million come back? What will happen to the state of Israel? Not to mention that 20% of Israel's population is already made up of Palestinians who are called Israeli Arabs. But whose loyalties, what are we, crazy? We're making a distinction between Israeli Arabs and Palestinians? Did people make distinctions when it came to Zionism between Polish Jews and Jews who live in Yerushalayim? Did we make distinctions of this sort? Why are we so into fooling ourselves? So then, you know, the question is, somebody just made a comment here to my right, which not all of you absorbed, but the comment was, oy. So where's the hope? Where's the possibility? What can be done here? Well, first of all, you know, to show you the duplicity, the when people have a goal, no matter what you do, it's not going to be enough. Did Israel do anything when it met, you know, when Bush spoke from Aqaba and Mahmoud Abbas took over? Well, what had it done? It had released more than, let's keep the record straight now. Let's not forget history so quickly. Let's not fall victim to what Santayana said. And let's understand that Israel started releasing Palestinian prisoners. Right away they said, that's not enough. You're only releasing people whose terms are up. We weren't supposed to release anybody under the terms, and they agreed to those terms, the roadmap. Israel released 400 Palestinians. It issued 18,000 extra work permits for Palestinians in Israel. It released $450 million in frozen funds. All this in August for the Palestinian Authority. And it suspended the targeted killings of Palestinian militants in Gaza once Palestinian authorities took control there. It in addition, redeployed its forces. It withdrew from Gaza and Bethlehem. It opened up a major road in Gaza. It lifted 3 major roadblocks in the West Bank. It dismantled 12 unauthorized settlements, house posts in the West Bank. And it held 4 meetings between Sharon and Abbas. So to the question that we didn't do anything, that's baloney. We did plenty. Certainly for a start. But that start was never taken any further than that start. Now, can there be hope? I want to tell you something personally. When I went to Washington University in St. Louis, I had to have a room in the dormitory. And the only, you know, there weren't too many rooms available. So the guy giving out the dorm room said to me, who would you like to have as a roommate? So, well, I know. I said, give me a roommate, give me a graduate student in sociology. I figured at least I'd have that in common with him. I mean, you can't tell the Somalian guy who's giving out the rooms you want a frum Jew to be your roommate. So I walked into the room. I was wearing a baseball cap. He had no idea who I was. And I see this fellow. He looks kind of Jewish. I introduce myself. Hi, my name is Bill Helmersh. I'm from New York. He says, I'm Ali El Hawat, and I'm from Libya. So I say, well, Ali, you know, I just
I just want you to know I'm Jewish. So, you know, if you want to move out, now's the time. He says, I'm not moving out. This is my room. I said, Ali, you got it all wrong. This isn't your room. This is our room, and I ain't moving out either. So he looked at me for a long moment as opposed to a short moment. Long and short, I measure in terms of how it feels. It's a subjective consideration. And he said, well, I guess we stayed. And yes, folks, stay we did. We were roommates the whole year. It wasn't a problem because he wasn't a real ideologue. The main thing is he wanted to meet nice women in America. He also used to tell me, you can get me, girl. I said, I can't get you anything. What do you want from me? I said to him, listen, Ali, why don't you smarten up? Let me tell you something. If you'll stop telling all these women you're going out with that your father is a civil servant in the city of Homs, 110 miles away from Tripoli, and start telling them that your father is a rich oil sheik, you'll have all the girls you want. So he did. And he did. He did very well. Now you saw at the end of, if I could take you back to the beginning of the 12-minute video, you saw this Arab doctor, this Palestinian doctor by the name of Izzeldin Abu Yaish, saying, we were so close to that time in 2000, and how I wish we could come there. Let me tell you something. I've gotten to know Izzeldin. He works at Soroka Hospital in Beersheba, and he is a genuinely good human being, and he represents another face of the Palestinian community. This man, he wants his land, he wants his independence, but he is willing to live in peace. He's at the other end of the extreme of Rantisi. But now, I want to show you an excerpt from somebody who's in the middle. Ahmed Dahlan was the security chief during the years of the Oslo Accord, sharing it with Rajoub. And Dahlan is a pragmatic Palestinian. When I interviewed him, he was in charge of security. Now he's not. That doesn't mean anything. You know, we learn when we do this film. One day he's in, one day he's out. As long as he's alive, he's still in. So one of the people I interviewed isn't alive anymore, Abu Shanab. He died. The Israelis killed him. But when it comes to Dahlan is trying to deal with a problem on the ground. And I'll get to the solution, but first let's take a look at Dahlan and let's listen to what this security chief tells you about his problem. And listen carefully what he tells you about the settlements like Netzarim in Gaza. And think about it. I want you, you know, as much as you can process something in a short period of time, I know it's difficult, but try and focus on what he's saying. Because again, this is not an interview you'll see in the press, but it expresses the issues that he has to deal with. Please. Can we cut the lights? This is the last interview, and then I'll have a couple of closing comments, and then I want to open it up. The suicide, that the people with explosives have the, not the right, but he meant they have the ability to pass by, and they never check. And when I said I had seen this humiliation, I had seen it. It was certainly excessive, but you also have to understand, as I'm sure some of you do, that in the cases where it's excessive, the soldier who is checking the person may be out for revenge because his sister got killed in a suicide bombing. It's not so simple. In fact, nothing about this is simple. Now, the theme of this film is going to be, I want to be out front about it, is that the real problem is that the Palestinian movement has been hijacked by radicals, and that those radicals do not want any kind of a peaceful solution to this problem because it would not serve their ideological, national, religious interests. And that as long as they are in charge, there can be no peace. And the only answer is to eliminate them. Either send them away to some island forever, kill them, do whatever you have to do. Even the Torah gives you the right to do that by saying, Habola hargacha hashkein vahargo. If you're fighting in a battle of self-defense, you have the right to do what is necessary to save your own life. These people are not interested in negotiations. Yes, would Rantisi allow you to live? Sure. The way Jews in Arab countries lived 200 years ago, where they couldn't ride a horse, where they had to walk behind somebody, where they could be killed with impunity, where they lived in ghettos. Yeah, that way he wants you to live. If you want to live that way, then you can live. That's a solution, if anybody regards it as a solution.
So what do we do? And then even before saying what do we do, there's one other thing that I learned on this trip which was very clearly impressed upon me. The average Palestinian is not a suicide bomber. The average Palestinian wants to get up in the morning, go to work, and come home at night and see his family, make a living, go on vacation, and live. It is a myth to think that they're all bloodthirsty people ready to die. If they were all ready to die, we wouldn't be able to solve this problem, because instead of 10 suicide bombers to deal with in 2 months, we'd have to deal with 10,000. They want to live. Would they like you dead? Probably. But they know they can't have you dead. So they know that if they're going to live out their own lives in peace, and this is what we have to make it clear to them, that they're going to have to live with us in peace, no matter what they think of us. There are lots of people who don't like us, but they still let us live. In other words, the solution is very simple. Make the price of war higher than the price of peace, and you will have peace. On the other hand, will you ever be able to turn your back on them? No. Not if we live there 500 years will we be able to completely turn our back on them unless things change. And I'm no Navi. That was taken away with the Khorban. I'm not claiming to prophecy, but I doubt it. And the reason I doubt it is that fundamentally, we are not the same people. I do believe in the contact hypothesis. I believe that if we have contact with them, we can take good souls like this doctor and we can live with him in peace. But for the average person, he'd rather not see you around. On the other hand, he doesn't want to lose his own life. Now, people say to me, there's no solution to the Middle East. You know what I say to them? You're right. Do you know something? Not everything has a solution. Big cities in the world like New York have been trying to deal with crime since its inception. They can only control it. They cannot eliminate it. If a person has terminal cancer, you can't cure them. They have terminal cancer. In this particular case, the Middle East, because of the confluence of various factors, is at this point not a place that has a solution. But there's one thing that's clear, and what's clear is that we have to live. The demographic problems are there. They are increasing arithmetically, maybe even geometrically, and one day they will outnumber us. One day, very, very soon. And then we will confront the question of what is to be the character of the state of Israel. But there's one thing I have to say. We have to trust in God, because ultimately, without God, we can't do anything. But we also, God tells us that we have to trust in ourselves, that we have to try to make the best of the situation. And the wall is an interim solution. It's not the solution. I close simply with telling you that the word mazal stands for three words, makom, zman, la'asot. We have to have luck. But we have to be in that place, we have to be there when we have to be, and we have to do something about it. And only if we understand the dangers can we even begin to hope and dream of the possibilities of peace. Thank you very much. Any questions? Yes, sir.
Professor, as an American academic with a clearly Germanic name, and you happen to be Jewish and from, how do you pull the wool over their eyes for them to achieve a one-on-one interview with them? They're paranoid as it is that everyone is a Zionist. How do you do this?
Well, okay. The question is, how did I manage to do this and still come back here to talk about it? Well, first of all, just as a matter of biographical note, my first book was about the Black Panthers, whom I lived, worked, and traveled with for 6 months. So that kind of excitement isn't strange to me. I don't take any credit for not being afraid. Fear or courage are more, in my mind, instincts. In other words, in dangerous situations, some people run, some people fight. Nobody really thinks it's through. So I don't want any kudos for what I did. It's just the way I am. However, as to the logistics of doing it, Helmreich is not a problem. You know, somebody told me, yeah, but Helmreich is a Jewish name. I said, how do you know it's a Jewish name? And they said, well, you're Jewish. This is, in my sociology classes, that is not a logically coherent position to take. It happens to be that only my family is Jewish among the people named Helmreich. All the Helmreiches that I know who are Jewish are related to me, and the other 2,000 families,
some of which invited my father to neo-Nazi reunions during the 50s, are not Jewish. It also says on my passport that I was born in Switzerland. So, if I'm not wearing a kippah, I came to the United States, I was born in Switzerland, my name is Helmreich, I'm obviously German, so I'm a good guy. I'm one of the other guy's friends, you know, like Ahmed, likes me. As a matter of fact, I remember, I speak German fluently, and I remember when I was in an airport in Frankfurt, a man said to me in German, he saw my passport, I'm from New York, he says, what is a guy like you doing living in New York? You should be here in Germany with us, with the rest of us. I said, well, the problem is they didn't let us stay, so, you know, we have to leave. Now, I want you to know, though, speaking seriously, that Daniel Pearl was killed, and he was a journalist, but he was killed by a Pakistani. And that over the years of the Intifada, over the long years of the Intifada and since the occupation, I do not know of any journalist who was kidnapped and or killed by the Palestinians. For the Palestinians, we are gold. We are the people who enabled them to tell their story and in some cases spread their lies, and they don't want to harm us. They're smart enough to understand that harming me would not be to their benefit. Now, will they get a better or worse story? Some of them knew I was Jewish. Some of them didn't know I was Jewish. Really, it doesn't matter to a devout Muslim whether you're a Christian or a Jew. Look at the Quran. You know, they're not equal opportunity employers. It doesn't really matter. So that I got through by just staying cool, I guess. I mean, there were many situations. For example, we had these long checkpoints that we had to get through. And I would tell them, you know, I didn't want to wait at these checkpoints. I got things to do. Who wants to stand in a line for 4 hours? So I would say to these guys, listen, I'm an American. So if you'll let me go up to these Israeli soldiers, I'll talk them into letting us go through. So they say, yeah, you're an American. I never let them know that I know Hebrew. And then I would go up to the, I would go up to the Israeli guy and I would say something like, Shmana, anachno sim seret l'azbarat Yisrael, efshar lavo? Which means, excuse me, we're doing a good public relations film for Israel. Can we get by? We don't have all day. I don't want to speak Hebrew in front of these Arabs. Sure, go right ahead. The Palestinians would say, oh, he did it. He got us through. They didn't know. So, you know, I'll tell you something. I teach research methods at the Graduate Center at CUNY, and we teach field work. And field work is not really something you can train a person to do. Either you're quick or you're not quick. And if you're not quick, you're finished. And it wouldn't help you to read 100 books on how to do field work. And if you are quick, you don't need any of the books to do field work. Yes, any other questions?
There's one more over here, Dr. Helmer.
Yes.
And then we'll wrap it up.
In your interview with Rantisi, you let him speak about his idea of the tragedy that happened in 1948, that we killed all these Palestinians and we kicked them out of their homes. So at any other point, that maybe it's on the other film or in your conversation, did you ever, like, challenge his idea that Jews were never there and discuss the fact that we were there over the years, that we had a historical claim to the land as well? And if you did bring that up to him, what did he say in response?
Okay.
And number two, at the checkpoints where they let the Palestinians with explosives, what's that explained by? Explain why they do the humiliation, maybe out of revenge if their sister was killed, but was that just an oversight? So those are two.
Well, which explosives? What are you referring to
you
in the second?
At the checkpoints, they let Palestinians through with explosives if they don't check them.
Oh, no. Okay. I'll answer the second one first because it's the easier one, and then we'll know we'll at least got one of them.
I'm interested in the first part.
Then you shouldn't have asked the second one. So I'll answer both. Don't worry. We'll take it. Don't worry. They'll both get answered. The second one is very easy. They slip by. They don't go through the checkpoints altogether. Okay? And then to the answer to the first one, when we're doing interviews, we do not seek to challenge people because then we destroy the rapport of the interview. I could easily ask them all these questions. I did not ask them those questions at later points because I have Arab scholars and academics and ideologues and intellectuals. When you're sitting in Gaza City, you don't challenge a person on the veracity of his account because then it's only a one-way ticket. Basically, I want to let him speak. I want to let him hang himself by his own words. I know the challenge, and you do too. But the point is, we want to let him say what he wants to say because then I put what he says together with what somebody else says. He's not the be-all, end-all, middle, beginning, end point of this particular interview. So that
Of course we know that they didn't do hundreds of massacres. I mean, we're having enough trouble defending Daryushin, and he's telling us about hundreds? But you see, the point is, when you challenge a person, then he doesn't relax. And when he doesn't relax, he doesn't tell you that 7 billion people should come back, and he doesn't tell you that the Zionists want to take over Iraq and Jordan. And that's what I want to hear from him, because I want to put that on the college campuses. I want the students to see those things, and then they will know what the Israelis are dealing with.
Thank you very much.